Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, June 14th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, MISD board members call for special election. Two school board members want short-term appointment followed by November special election to deal with Murray's resignation. By Stuart Doreen. If Midland ISD Board President Brian Murray resigns his seat as expected, a conversation among school board members is expected to take place immediately concerning how to fill that position. Murray is also the representative of District 7, which includes the following areas: Greentree, Saddle Club Ranch Estates, Briarwood, Great House, a section bordered by Garfield Street on the east, Midland Drive on the west, Bluebird Avenue on the north, and Loop 250 on the south, and another section bordered by Loop 250 and Briarwood to the north, Wadley Avenue to the south, Holiday Hill and Loop 250 to the west, and Midkiff Road to the east. A special meeting is scheduled for noon Thursday at the Central Administration Building. On the Midland ISD agenda, it mentioned the, quote, consideration and possible action regarding resignation of Trustee Brian Murray, unquote. It also mentions that action arising from executive session also calls for the discussion and take possible action if necessary regarding the process for appointing a replacement board member. An appointment is mentioned multiple times, but Midland ISD Superintendent Stephanie Howard mentioned the board can use one of three options. They include: the board could appoint someone to fill the vacancy until the end of the term, November 2024. The board could hold a special election to fill the position until the end of the term. The special election could be held no earlier than November 2023. The board can appoint someone to fill the vacancy and conduct a special election in November 2023 to fill the position until the end of the term, November 2024. The Reporter Telegram emailed the six other board members about which direction they would like to see the district go when it came to Murray's replacement, specifically asking about an appointment or a special election. Murray's term ends in November 2024. District 1 trustee Michael Booker told the Reporter Telegram that his opinion is that he personally thinks we need to appoint someone in District 7 to serve out the term until November's special election is done, so that District 7 will at least have a voice for the next 6 months. We should allow the constituents of District 7 to pick their representative in an election to serve out the remaining term. District 5 trustee Brandon Hodges stated, "The most appropriate process moving forward from my perspective is a short-term appointment and call for a special election to be held in November of 2023. Whomever was appointed could run along with any other person in District 7. It is all about making sure we are being transparent on the process, following the state laws of Texas, and making sure voters have a say in their representation." Both Booker and Hodges said they were speaking for themselves and not other school board members. No other responses were received. Murray said on his Facebook page that he looks forward to running for the seat again as soon as it is legally possible. Murray said Monday, state law requires his resignation to allow his sons to accept jobs to teach and coach at Legacy High School. This article is entitled, "Facilities Director Outlines Budget Needs," by Ben Schaffer. The Director of Facilities and Operations for Midland County discussed operations, staff, and his department's plan for the upcoming fiscal year, including at the Horseshoe Complex, at a special meeting of the Commissioner's Court. Eddie Melendez is one of the Midland County department heads who are presenting their respective budgets for next fiscal year this week. Melendez said he wants to repurpose a few of the positions in his department, giving some Midland County facility staff members new responsibilities and higher pay, pending approval from the county. He also discussed landscaping, the Horseshoe Complex, and internal education and training. Some of the changes include repurposing the administrative assistant role to executive administrative assistant and increase the salary from $43,872 to $48,834. Repurposing the facility maintenance technician to facilities electrical specialist. The salary would increase from $42,095 to $53,327. Adding $20,000 to the landscaping budget for the new sheriff's office at the Parsley Building. Budgeting $40,000 for janitorial supplies at the Horseshoe. With the county operating the Horseshoe, facilities officials want to provide janitorial services, which would include all janitorial supplies, according to Melendez. Midland County has recently begun to search for a county employee to be the director of the Horseshoe Complex since the contract cancellation between Midland County and Horseshoe Hospitality. Melendez noted many times during his presentation that he and his facility staff plan to work closely with the new Horseshoe director and the county's new Horseshoe department whenever a director is hired and when a department is formed. The Midland County Department budget requests will not be approved by the Commissioner's Court until later this summer. This article is entitled Midland City Council Honors the Late Michael Trost by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council honored the late Michael Trost on Tuesday. A presentation of a proclamation calling June 13th Michael Trost Day took place as Mayor Pro Tem John Norman read the proclamation and then handed it to Michael's wife Leanna, who was given a standing ovation by those inside council chambers in Midland City Hall. Trost was a two-time council member, serving both as a representative of District 4 and then as an at-large member. Trost also showed off his acting ability with Midland Community Theater and Mavericks. Trost passed away on May 18th in Midland. This article is entitled Oil Pipelines Hike Rates by a Record as Red-Hot Inflation Bites by Sheila Tobin, Bloomberg. The cost of moving oil on pipelines crisscrossing the U.S. is surging by the most ever as operators pass on higher business expenses to their customers. Shippers who haven't signed contracts will see rates jump by an all-time high of 13.3% after, quote, red-hot inflation, unquote, last year. While the increase will vary for customers with contracts, consulting firm East Daily Analytics said in a note to clients. The tariffs, which are based on an annual adjustment from U.S. regulators, are rising by a record for the second year in a row. We anticipate a portion of these hikes will ultimately impact prices at the pump and be passed on to consumers, but doubtful they will significantly impact refining runs, according to A.J. O'Donnell, East Daily's Director of Equity Research. He said that while transport costs are important, they pale in comparison to economic factors, such as interest rates, which would have a more meaningful impact on refining and distribution of fuels. Skyrocketing pipeline rates reflect a broader trend of higher costs across the energy industry. Wages for U.S. oil workers hit a record in April, even as paycheck growth eased in other sectors. Prices for equipment and materials have also climbed. Pipeline operators are adjusting rates depending on the commodity and type of service, with natural gas liquids and refined products bearing the brunt of the increases. Competitive corridors like the route from West Texas's Permian Basin to the Gulf Coast are offering shippers the biggest break. This article is entitled OPD, Infant Airlifted to Lubbock Following Crash with Drunk Driver, by Mercedes Cordero. A 36-year-old Odessa woman is facing intoxication assault charges, and an infant was airlifted to a Lubbock hospital following a two-vehicle crash Monday night, according to the Odessa Police Department. Odessa police responded at about 11:17 p.m. to the intersection of Maple Avenue and Grandview Avenue. Officers were informed that one of the drivers involved in the crash had fled the scene on foot. The driver, identified as 36-year-old Daisy Cordero, was detained by officers. Witnesses had identified her as the driver of a 2007 Lexus RX 350, according to OPD. According to the investigation, Cordero was traveling northbound in the Lexus on Grandview Avenue when she rear-ended a 2014 Chevrolet Cruze stopped at a red light. Two children, a one-month-old girl and a one-year-old boy, were in the back seat of the Cruze at the time. The one-month-old suffered life-threatening injuries and was airlifted to Lubbock. The children's mother and the one-year-old boy were transported to Medical Center Hospital, where they were treated for their injuries. Cordero has been charged with intoxication assault causing serious bodily injuries, a third-degree felony, unlawful carrying of a weapon, Class A misdemeanor, accident involving serious bodily injuries, a third-degree felony, and bribery. Cordero was transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. This article is entitled, Passenger Dies in Two-Vehicle Collision in South Midland, by Mercedes Cordero. An 87-year-old woman died Monday following a two-vehicle accident in South Midland, according to the Midland Police Department. Officers responded Monday at about 12:57 p.m. to a two-vehicle fatality accident in the 1900 block of South La Mesa Road. MPD's initial investigation revealed a Mercedes sedan was traveling southbound on South La Mesa Road, as a Toyota minivan was traveling northbound. The minivan moved into the left-hand turn lane, and while attempting to turn onto the 1100 block of East Gist Street, collided with the sedan. Two occupants of the minivan, a female driver, 67, a female passenger, 87, and the male driver of the sedan, 33, were transported by EMS. A minivan passenger, Sally Garcia, died from her injuries sustained in the crash. The investigation is ongoing. The next of kin has been notified. The fatality is the 20th reported inside Midland County this year, according to Reporter-Telegram records, and the first reported in more than 1 month. This article is entitled, Saudi Cuts Will Tighten Oil Market Sharply, OPEC Data, by Grant Smith, Bloomberg. Saudi Arabia's latest oil production cuts are set to tighten global markets sharply next month, data from OPEC show. Even before the kingdom announced its surprise new measures just over a week ago, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries expected that world inventories would deplete rapidly in the second half, amid a post-pandemic recovery in fuel demand. With the 1 million barrel a day cutback to be implemented by Riyadh in July, and possibly longer, the shortfall will intensify. World consumption will exceed supplies by roughly 2.7 million barrels a day next month, a report from OPEC indicated on Tuesday. If the kingdom opted to extend the reduction for the whole third quarter, it would be the biggest deficit since 2021. Despite the projected tightness, crude traders have so far reacted with indifference to the new curbs unveiled by Saudi Energy Minister Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman on June 4th. Brent futures have declined 4% to near $73 a barrel since Riyadh's plan emerged, as fears over lackluster demand in China take center stage. The price retreat may be welcomed by the U.S. and other consuming nations, which have condemned OPEC and its allies for stoking inflation by withholding oil supplies. But it could be painful for producers like the Saudis, which the IMF believes needs oil prices above $80 to cover government spending. OPEC's 13 members cut supplies last month by 464,000 barrels a day to just over 28 million a day as they implemented curbs announced in April, according to the report. That's considerably short of the 29.9 million a day that the cartel estimates is needed in the third quarter, even before the new Saudi cut is applied. Once Riyadh goes ahead with the extra 1 million barrel a day reduction in July, the shortfall will deepen to roughly 2.7 million barrels a day. Prince Abdulaziz has said he will keep markets in suspense on whether the cut will remain in place in later months. The organization's forecasts hinge on a significant increase in global demand next quarter, of about 1.2 million barrels a day. For 2023 as a whole, OPEC's Vienna-based secretariat predicts that consumption will climb by a hefty 2.3 million barrels a day to average 101.9 million a day. The International Energy Agency, which advises consuming nations, will release its latest projections for global supply and demand, including its first detailed assessment of 2024, on Wednesday. This article is entitled "Texas Heat Intensifying Through Week." Electricity usage expected to break the power demand record. By Noreen S. Malik, Bloomberg. Texas's fragile power grid will be pushed to the brink in coming days as unusually hot weather grips the second largest U.S. state. Electricity usage is forecast to break the all-time high by the end of the week, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, warned. With temperatures expected to top 100 degrees in Houston, Dallas, and other Lone Star State cities, air conditioning use is expected to soar to 80.3 gigawatts on Thursday and even higher on Friday. The record set last summer was 80.1 gigawatts. The state capital, Austin, issued its first heat advisory of the season on Tuesday and opened cooling centers for residents without air conditioners. In Houston, passengers awaiting flights at George Bush Intercontinental Airport sweltered for a second straight day because the air conditioning system wasn't fully functioning. Statewide, power supplies will be especially stretched on Friday, when demand is projected to hover at a record level for four consecutive hours, according to ERCOT data. The reserve margin, or buffer of extra electricity supplies, may shrink to as little as 5.3% during that stretch. Even before the worst of the heat has descended, National Weather Service forecasters were warning that in some parts of the state Tuesday, it will feel like it's 114 Fahrenheit. The Texas grid normally doesn't see demand spike this early in the cooling season. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, U.S. Plans to Buy 12 Million Barrels of Oil for Reserve This Year, by Ari Natter and Jennifer Jacobs, Bloomberg. The U.S. plans to purchase about 12 million barrels of oil this year as it begins to refill its depleted emergency reserve amid falling crude prices, according to two people familiar with the matter. The figure includes 3 million barrels already scheduled for delivery in August, and an additional 3 million barrels from a solicitation the Biden administration issued on Friday, according to the people. An Energy Department spokesperson said they will continue to seek opportunities for additional repurchases as market conditions and the constraints of SPR operations allow. The White House didn't immediately comment. The more than 700 million barrel capacity Strategic Petroleum Reserve is at a 40-year low following a historic 180 million barrel drawdown last year in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Oil traders have been closely watching while the government begins refilling the emergency stockpile, as its purchases are bound to tighten the market. The sour crude grades sought by the Energy Department are in high demand as a result of OPEC Plus cutting output. Any additional pull on domestic barrels could send oil prices higher, potentially raising gasoline prices in the middle of the summer driving season, and possibly dissuading the Biden administration from replenishing the reserve in larger quantities. The DOE seems to be looking to replenish the reserve in a series of small nibbles rather than big bites, perhaps to minimize upside pressure on crude in the summer driving season and the presidential election season. Washington-based consulting firm Clearview Energy Partners wrote in a note to clients on Friday. The Biden administration last fall said the aim was to refill the reserve when prices were at or below about $67 to $72 a barrel. West Texas Intermediate futures climbed 3.4% on Tuesday to settle at $69.42 a barrel. WTI is down almost 14% this year. This article is entitled, Woman Dies in Crash in Ector County, by the Midland Reporter-Telegram. A Stanton woman died Monday afternoon in a two-vehicle crash in Ector County, according to the Department of Public Safety. DPS reported that preliminary information showed a 2009 Ford F-250 was traveling northbound on Farm to Market Road 1936. And a 2010 Ford Edge was traveling westbound on State Highway 302. The 2009 Ford F-250 crossed the eastbound lanes of State Highway 302, and the driver of the F-250 failed to yield the right-of-way to the 2010 Ford Edge as the Ford F-250 crossed the westbound lanes, resulting in a crash. DPS reported Ashley Lopez, 40, of Stanton, died at the scene, according to DPS. She was a passenger in the F-250. The driver was from Midland. The accident took place around 12:20 p.m. northwest of Odessa. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, June 14th. Colby Grace Grover. Colby Grace Grover passed away in Lubbock on Saturday, May 13th, 1 month shy of her 23rd birthday. Colby was born on June 13th, 2000, in Midland. A memorial service will be held at First Presbyterian Church in Midland on Friday, June 16th at 1:30 p.m., with Pastor Steve Shore officiating, followed by a reception at the home of Rosalind Grover. Colby is survived by her father, David Grover of Dallas, her two sisters, Riley Grover and Landry Grover, her grandparents, Dusty and Barbara Rhodes, her tutu, Rosalind Grover, all of Midland, as well as many uncles, aunts, and cousins. Colby is preceded in death by her mother, Kelly Rhodes Grover, and her grandfather, Arden R. Grover. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be directed to Permian Basin Behavioral Health Center, P.O. Box 61950, Midland, or to the Kelly Rhodes Grover Memorial Fund. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. James Jamie L. Lucas, Jr. James Jamie L. Lucas, Jr. left this worldly plane on June 19, 2023, surrounded by loved ones. He was born in Texarkana, sadly on the Arkansas side, on April 19, 1951, to Jim and Potty Lucas. He is survived by his wife Brenda, his brothers Paul and wife Susan, Tim and wife Julie, his children Jessica, Joe and his spouse Jessica, Aaron and Madeline, as well as grandchildren Haley, Bennett, and Eleanor. He was preceded in death by his parents, Jim and Potty Lucas, as well as his brother, Tom Jack. A small celebration of life will happen Wednesday, June 14th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Manny's Italian Village in Midland. The full memorial service will occur later in the year, and the family will announce those details. In lieu of flowers, please make memorial donations to the First Presbyterian Church of El Dorado, Texas, or the Alzheimer's Association. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Robin Marie Hawker Fuller. Robin Marie Hawker Fuller, 79, of Midland, passed away on June 7th. A visitation will be from 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, June 15th, at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Services will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday, June 16th, at Macedonia Baptist Church, 201 South Carver Street in Midland. Robin Marie Hawker Fuller was born on August 30, 1943, to Alvin Pete Hawker and Rosine Butler Hawker in Clarksville, Texas. In 1955, her family moved to Midland. Robin is survived by her husband, James E. Fuller of Midland, son Jason Fuller, siblings Rosla L. Hawker, her twin sister, Iwo Hawker Lee Villard, Lottie Hawker Burns, Jerron Hawker, Gwinnett Hawker Burns Wilbord, Larry Hawker Kathy, Michael Hawker Gloria, as well as many grandchildren and great-grandchildren and nieces and nephews. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Bertha Starks Scholarship at Viola M. Coleman High School. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. Oliver Wendell Dean. Oliver Wendell Dean, 94, of Midland, passed away June 11th. The family will receive guests from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday, June 18th, at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, June 19th, at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Rosa Ana Robledo. Rosa Ana Robledo, age 64, of Midland, went to be with the Lord June 10th. Visitation will be Wednesday, June 14th, at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home Chapel, from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., with a rosary starting at 7 p.m. Funeral services will be held on Thursday, June 15th, at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home at 10 a.m., interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Online condolences can be made at asanchestfh.com.
County Auditor resigns. Investigation underway. Ector County Auditor Randy Donner resigned Monday morning after being called into a meeting with County Judge Dustin Fawcett and the HR director. Fawcett said Tuesday an investigation by an outside agency into possible financial irregularities is underway and that an interim from within the department will be utilized. Donner had been auditor for 4 years and with Ector County for 16 years. Fawcett said there would be no other comment as an outside agency continues the investigation and also declined to name the agency. The auditor is appointed by district judges. Texas lawmakers pull funding for child ID kits after investigation finds little evidence of their effectiveness. For months, Texas lawmakers were on track to spend millions of taxpayer dollars to continue distributing child identification kits to Texas schoolchildren, a program championed by state officials. In April, both the Texas House and Senate approved preliminary budgets that included money for the National Child Identification Program's kits. But less than a month after a ProPublica Texas Tribune investigation found no evidence the kits have helped locate missing children, lawmakers quietly zeroed out the funding. The news outlets also found that the Waco-based company that distributes the kits had used exaggerated statistics as it sought contracts in Texas and other states. And the investigation revealed that Kenny Hashmeyer, a former NFL player who leads the company, had a string of failed businesses, had millions of dollars in outstanding federal tax liens, and had previously been barred from some finance-related business in Connecticut by banking regulators because of his role in an alleged scheme to defraud or mislead investors. After review and consideration, the House and Senate budget conferees agreed to remove this specific funding request for the upcoming biennium, said State Senator Joan Huffman, a Republican from Houston, who chairs the Senate Finance Committee. Huffman did not elaborate on the closed-door discussions of the lawmakers who had been appointed to work out differences between the two spending plans. A 2021 law states that the Texas Education Agency, which was tasked with purchasing the kits, isn't required to continue providing them if the legislature stops the funding. In a statement, a spokesman said the agency isn't aware of any alternative funding sources for the program. Hashmeyer, who did not respond to emailed questions for this article, has said the kits help law enforcement find missing children and save time during the early stages of a search. But none of the Texas law enforcement agencies contacted by the news outlets could recall the kits having helped to find a missing child. Hashmeyer previously said that his legal disputes, including his sanction in Connecticut, had been properly resolved, closed, and are completely unrelated to the National Child ID Program. He also claimed to have paid debts entirely, but did not provide details. An Odessa woman was arrested late Monday night following a two-vehicle crash that resulted in life-threatening injuries for a one-month-old girl. According to the city of Odessa, Daisy Cordero, 32, was driving a Lexus RX 350 when she rear-ended a Chevy Cruze that had stopped for a red light on Grandview at Maple Avenue around 11:15 p.m. The baby was in the back seat of the Chevy, along with a one-year-old boy. According to the city, the boy and the 19-year-old driver of the Chevy were taken to Medical Center Hospital and treated for their injuries. The baby was flown to a Lubbock hospital. Cordero was arrested on suspicion of intoxication, assault causing serious bodily injuries, unlawful carrying of a weapon, accident involving serious bodily injuries, and bribery. The latter charge is the most serious she's facing and is punishable by 2 to 20-year prison sentence. She remains in the Ector County Jail Tuesday afternoon. No bonds have yet been set. Jail records show Cordero was arrested in May on a possession of a controlled substance charge. IDEA Public Schools offering free summer meals to children 18 and under. With one campus each in Odessa and Midland, IDEA Public Schools is offering summer meals through July the 21st. Summer meals include breakfast and lunch and must be eaten in the cafeteria of any IDA campus Monday through Friday. Breakfast is served from 7:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. and lunch from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Food service will be closed on federal holidays and from July the 3rd to the 7th. Vice President of Schools for IDA Public Schools of the Permian Basin, Aaron Fong, said this is the second year IDA has provided summer meals and they hope to continue it. Any child, whether you are an IDEA student or not, is welcome to come to one of our campuses, entering through the front entrance. Adults should plan to bring form of stay verified identification because we do not have summer school running through the summer. And just as an added precaution, we just want to ensure that we are being extra cautious with who we're allowing on campus. But in terms of the meal, show up. We'll lead you to the cafeteria for either breakfast or lunch. We do ask that you do eat your meal in the cafeteria. Meals are free of charge, 100%, for anyone 18 or younger. Anyone over the age of 18, we will charge a small fee per item a la carte, or $5 for a full meal, Fong said. He added that it's no questions asked. Some days only a handful of people show up, but other days there are several tables with people dying. The sad but unacceptable truth in our country is that one out of six children in the state of Texas is considered food insecure, meaning they're unsure of where their next meal might come from at times. During the school year, two out of their three meals are provided at the school. What we want to do is ensure that when families are transitioning from the school year to the summer, it's seamless and students will not have to worry about those two meals, Fong said. He added that the last thing a learner should have to worry about is their next meal. If we can just take one less insecurity away from them, we know that they will have far more likelihood to thrive. Also, a healthy body creates a healthy mind, which is conducive to learning, Fong said. The public charter school has IDEA Yukon at 7300 East Yukon Road in Odessa and IDEA Travis at 900 East Gist Avenue in Midland. They use state and federal funds to pay for the child nutritional program. It matters not what city you live in. It matters not what school you go to. All are welcome, said Mr. Fong. U.S. online asylum appointments halted at one Texas crossing because of Mexican City's safety woes. McAllen, Texas. The Biden administration said Tuesday that the reason it has halted online asylum appointments at the international crossing in Laredo, Texas, was because of the security situation across the border in the Mexican city of Nuevo Laredo. U.S. Customs Border Protection said in a statement emailed to the Associated Press that the government also took into account other unspecified operational factors, including relatively low demand for appointments for that location. The government released the statement a day after AP, Associated Press, reported the change, which took effect June the 3rd at the Laredo port of entry. Humanitarian groups in Laredo said they recently warned the administration in meetings, both in person and on Zoom, about people controlling access to the port of entry on the Mexican side and migrants reporting being extorted after flying to Nuevo Laredo. Asylum seekers told AP that Mexican immigration officials in Nuevo Laredo took their travel documents and threatened to make them miss their scheduled asylum appointments if they did not pay them. Nuevo Laredo is located in the Mexican state Tamaulipas, which Americans have been warned to avoid by the U.S. Department of State. Bordering the southern tip of Texas, Tamaulipas is a key area of the Cartel del Noreste, formerly known as the Gulf Cartel. CPB did not provide details about the security situation in Nuevo Laredo or what sets it apart from other Mexican border cities, including Tijuana, whose mayor decided this month to seek refuge at an army base for her own safety. Tijuana, across from San Diego, has one of the highest homicide rates in Mexico and is among the ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border, receiving the highest number of asylum appointments, CBP, one appointment. The Mexican president said the mayor, along with the governor of the state of Baja California, where Tijuana is located, have received threats from organized crime. Thousands of asylum seekers are stuck in Mexican border towns, waiting until they can get an appointment to seek refuge in the U.S. after being blocked during the COVID-19 pandemic by a public health restriction called Title 42. The restriction was lifted last month. Though the government opened some new avenues for immigration, the fate of many people is largely left to the CBP1 app that is used for scheduling an appointment at a port of entry. The government said it would continue to open 1,250 appointments daily by relocating the slots for Laredo to the 7 other crossings along the U.S.-Mexico border. It vowed to honor online appointments issued for the Laredo crossing before the June 3rd change. The government schedules appointments 2 weeks out. CBP gives priority to people with an app appointment, though people can try to be admitted by going in person without one. Anyone who has an acute medical condition or is under an immediate threat of kidnapping or death also can ask to be admitted in person. Laredo saw only a fraction of appointments compared to San Diego and Brownsville, Texas. Obituaries. Gladys Lucille Riggs, age 104, peacefully passed away on May the 29th. A graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, June the 16th at Sunset Memorial Gardens in Odessa. In lieu of flowers, you may donate in Gladys's memory to the American Cancer Society or the American Diabetes Association. Joe Taylor, age 84, of Odessa, passed away peacefully at his home on June the 10th. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, June the 14th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Memorials may be given to Meals on Wheels, Shriners Children's Hospital, or a charity of your choice. Ralph Preston Cherry passed away on June the 16th at the age of 89. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. on June the 16th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Keith Kirkland passed away on June the 8th at the age of 67. Graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. on June the 15th at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Billy McDougall, age 26, passed from this life on Wednesday, June the 7th, at his home in Odessa. Memorial services will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, June the 17th, at Chapel Hill Baptist Church in Odessa. Joyce Spivey, age 73, passed away on June the 7th. Visitation on June the 15th between 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. at the Martinez Funeral Chapels and Crematoria in Odessa. Tommy Wooten, at age 85, passed away on Thursday, June the 8th. No services have been scheduled at this time. Dora Subia, age 88, passed away peacefully in her sleep in the early morning hours of Monday, June the 5th. Commissioners approved contract to preserve historical documents. Historical documents belonging to the Ector County District Clerk, County Clerk, and Ector County Sheriff's Office will be preserved forever after the County Commissioners unanimously approved a contract with Cofile Technologies on Tuesday. District Clerk Carissa Webster said the county has important records going back to sovereignty that are not only taking up a lot of space, but are in danger of falling apart. According to materials provided to the commissioner's court, some records in the county clerk's office are secured with tape that is yellowing and the ink on them is dissolving. County Clerk Jennifer Martin also noted the documents in her office have also been further endangered by a termite infestation. While efforts had been made to digitize many of the documents, Webster said they wouldn't be able to digitize the rest in her lifetime and Co-File Technologies will be able to finish the project by the end of 2026. Co-File will capture, or in some cases, clean up and enhance such things as plats, commissioner court minutes, Ector County Sheriff's Office fingerprints, photos and case files, plus minute index and fee books. Once digitized, researchers will be able to find items exponentially faster than now when they have to dig through log books and then search for the actual documents themselves, Webster said. The commissioners agreed to use $7.5 million in American Rescue Plan Act money and $2 million in sales tax funds to pay for the project, along with money generated through filing fees. In other matters, the commissioners agreed to renew a contract with Burnett County to house Ector County inmates if necessary due to staffing shortages. The contract will increase the per diem to $80 from $75. The county currently doesn't have any inmates in Burnett County, Sheriff Mike Griffiths said. The shortage of jailers at the Ector County Adult Detention Facility came up later in the meeting when Ector County Judge Dustin Fawcett announced his top priorities for the upcoming budget season. He said his top priority is to increase the salaries of jailers and address the compression that will result with the county's other law enforcement officers. That being said, that means a lot of the other offices within the courthouse and the annex are not going to see as large of an increase as perhaps you'd been wanting. But for Ector County business to continue at a high rate, in which we are doing that, budget priority has to hemorrhage the bleeding that we have going on in our jail, and there's a huge obligation. So understand that this is our number one priority. My number one priority, Fawcett said. An 87-year-old woman died Monday afternoon in a two-vehicle crash in Midland. According to the city of Midland, a Toyota minivan collided with a Mercedes when the 67-year-old minivan driver attempted to turn onto the 1100 block of East Gist Street from South La Mesa Road. A passenger in the minivan, Sally Garcia, died from her injuries, and both drivers were taken to the hospital. STEM Summit draws teachers from across the region. Permian Basin teachers were beyond enthusiastic about STEM labs and the opportunities they provide during an inaugural STEM Summit Tuesday at Odessa College. About 100 teachers from 22 Permian Basin counties attended the summit, which was sponsored by the Permian Strategic Partnership and the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation in the Salisbury Campus Center. The event was emceed by CBS 7 anchor Jay Hendricks, and he moderated a panel discussion with teachers and a principal on the benefits of the STEM labs. STEM stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. By 2024, the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation will have installed 134 STEM centers in elementary schools across 22 counties in Texas and New Mexico. The Permian Basin STEM centers will impact students from pre-K through fifth grade, 65.5% of whom are living below the poverty level. Funders are the Permian Strategic Partnership and Cal Ripken Senior Foundation. Pease Elementary School Principal Micah Arott said the STEM lab installed at her campus in September 2022 sells itself. The students took their parents to see it. We left the door unlocked, we left the materials accessible, and they did the rest. At first I was like, oh my gosh, it's all new and this is thousands of dollars of equipment, Arott said. But then she took a breath. They have so much pride and are so proud of all the materials, Arnott said. They capitalized on family nights and got parents on board, she said. We partnered with our curriculum and instruction and digital learning specialists to have a coding night, and my STEM teacher does an amazing job of social media. She tweets out the things that they're learning within the STEM lab, Arrott said. Monica Almanza, a fifth-grade teacher at Rose Lawn Elementary School in Artesia, New Mexico, said STEM can be integrated across curriculums. It's amazing how fast students pick things up and school the adults, she said. The students learn quickly. They're fast learners. They teach the teachers. So it's not too difficult if your attitude is, we're going to do it and we're going to succeed. It's all in the attitude, Almanza said. Elizabeth Kiven teaches 3rd through 5th grade STEM at Greenwood Intermediate School. Kiven said the students are automatically super excited to go to her class because they know they're about to be hands-on. She gives the students a problem and they form their own groups, ideas, and examples of how they're going to solve it. It really helps to build their teamwork and being able to problem solve and think critically because they work together so seamlessly. Even my groups who, like was said earlier, may not normally pair up together, find that they work really well together, Kiven said. They recently competed in the National STEM Challenge and came in 3rd. The Young Women's Leadership Academy in Midland came in 1st. Arnott said they were fortunate to have Melissa Rivera as the main STEM resource on campus. She does a lot of the legwork for our teachers to help make their job easier in anything that they want to do, Arnott said. Joe Rossau, Senior Vice President of STEM Innovation and Outcome Measurements at the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation, said they are going to add 8 new lessons in the fall that tie into oil and gas, he said. Along with my team, we do Zoom trainings in the fall and in the spring to help reteach or go in depth with some of the areas, and in year 3 next year, they're adding a new educational product to it, Rossau said. They haven't decided what the educational product is going to be yet, he said. The centers are aimed at pre-kindergarten through 5th grade, so it starts students thinking about STEM from a young age. By the end of the year, we'll have over 400 STEM centers in 20-plus states across the country, impacting over 100,000 kids and about 3,000 teachers. So it's gotten really big, Rossau said. Having been in education for about 24 years before joining the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation, Rossau said it's a wonderful feeling to be able to help open doors for students. OC Vice President of Advancement, Business, and Governmental Relations, Jackie Gore said, the work teachers are doing in the Permian Basin and southeast New Mexico is very important. We're preparing the students who we hope will then come here to Odessa College to further their education. We're so pleased to work with the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation and Permian Strategic Partnership on hosting this event. We hope that we can do many more things with the Cal Ripken Foundation to continue to educate our students in the area. STEM is very important, and here at Odessa College, we really focus on growing our own. How can we prepare our students to fill all these wonderful, high-skill, high-wage job openings? We've talked to many people from across the country that say we have such a unique situation here in the Permian Basin and southeast New Mexico, where we have a number of great jobs. But how can we better prepare our students to take those jobs so that we don't have to recruit people from across the country to come out here? Gore added. Melissa Ware, Director of Education and Workforce at PSP, said she thinks having the summit in Odessa was a great opportunity for teachers. They were trained when the STEM centers were installed, but this takes it a step further. I love that we're providing teachers with opportunities to engage with experts that have created this program and that can help them learn and develop their skills on how to take it to their students, Ware said. Ware added that she is a boon for the workforce in the region. Like Jackie said, we have so many openings and we just don't have the skilled workforce that we need. It's crucial that we are developing these skills in our students so that they can grow into our future workforce, Ware said. The summit breakout sessions, led by industry experts, focused on topics such as integrating STEM practices within state standards, using 3D printers in the classroom, and utilizing robotics and coding tools.
This is the Dear Abby column. Former classmate in affair hopes for a future together. Dear Abby, in high school, I had a close male friend, Adam. After graduation, I moved out of state. We remained friends for a while in college, calling, writing, and visiting each other. He often declared his love for me, but I was interested only in friendship. As with most high school relationships, we lost contact. Now, rereading old letters from friends, I realized there was a constant theme that we were perfect for each other, and I should give him a chance. Fast forward 20 years. My husband and I went back for a high school reunion, and I met Adam's wife. We all went out to dinner and had a very nice time. Adam and I exchanged phone numbers, agreed to stay in touch, and we actually did. For 8 years, we have been texting and staying in touch. Our marriages have deteriorated, and we complain about our spouses, but also have real conversations and have grown very close. 3 months ago, we met halfway between our two cities and began an affair. We now meet once or twice a month and spend the day in bed. We call each other once a day and text constantly. He even came to my city with his best friend, who knows about us. I'm falling in love with Adam. He says he's unhappy and thinks about separating from his wife. I'd leave my husband for him and move to his state because his children are younger. He hasn't made any promises about the future, but he constantly tells me how his wife yells at him and belittles him. I think we could be very good together. How can I convince him we deserve this chance? Signed, High School Sweetheart. Dear Sweetheart, while you are willing to leave your husband, Adam's situation is more complicated. There are younger children involved, and as verbally abusive as his wife may be, he may not wish to disrupt their lives. Divorces are painful, messy, and expensive. I think it would be in your best interest to lay your cards on the table and ask Adam what his plans are regarding his wife and his children, and where you fit in. Then, cross your fingers and pray he is honest with you, because the odds are not in your favor. Just saying. Dear Abby, I'm married to a wonderful man, but his driving is very stressful for me. He usually drives 10 to 30 miles over the speed limit. Sometimes he'll approach a turn that's marked 25 doing 48. His car has a large digital readout of the speed, and I can easily see it. If I say anything, he gets very angry. And as he's getting older, mid-70s, his reaction time isn't optimal. Help. I don't know what to do. Signed, Stressed Spouse in Pennsylvania. Dear spouse, I can think of several things you can do. Stop looking at the speedometer. Sit in the back seat. Close your eyes and pray. Or drive yourself. You could write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.